let's move on to our next agenda item then, which is another PIR, which is the PIR of IFRS 10, IFRS 11, and IFRS 12. This PIR, this post-implementation review, is further advanced in its process than we are with IFRS 9. But let me hand over to Jen to introduce the topic.
Can you hear me, Nick? Thank you.
Yeah, we can hear you very clearly. Thank you.
Okay. When you would you put the PDF? Yeah. Yeah. Thank you, Wenyi. The last CMAC meeting we joined was October 2019. This was at the start of the post-implementation review of IFRS 10, 11, 12. And we also called Group Accounting Standards or Consolidation Pack. The objective of a post-implementation review is to assess the effects of a new requirement, that is whether the standards are working as intended. Last time we met, the board was obtaining information to help determining what matters it might examine in the next step. In December 2020, after considering the feedback we received in the first phase, the board published a request for information, and the comment period will end on 10th of May. We are now undertaking outreach of the matters for the board to decide what, if any, for the next, any actions to take. Slide 5 to 9 of this presentation set out some background information on this project and the standards that are part of this review. Further information about the standards can be found in the appendix of this slide deck, and I would like to start my presentation with slide 10. Slide 10, please. This slide provides an overview of the matters examined further in the request for information. At today's meeting, we would like to discuss the disclosure required by IFRS 12, disclosure of interest in the other entities. We hope the topics we identified are of interest to investors. However, if members have comments on any other matters examined in our document, please feel free to raise the matter. Slide 12, please. Slide 12 set out the objective of IFRS 12 disclosure requirements. IFRS 12 combines the disclosure requirements for subsidiary, joint arrangements, associates, and unconsolidated structure entities. To respond to call from investors to improve disclosure to help identify the profit loss and cash flow available to a reporting entity and determine the value of a current or future investment in the entity, IFRS 12 includes an overall disclosure objective and then sets out requirements to achieve that objective. Slide 14 is our presentation structure. To obtain your views on the disclosures, we have structured today's presentation as follows. First, an introduction of what IFRS 12 requires to disclose. We have then provided an example of disclosure, and finally, the question to you. The purpose of providing examples is to illustrate the disclosure requirements and to provide a general picture of what IFRS 12 disclosure looks like. The aim of the question is, of course, to understand your views on the information you obtained in reviewing financial statements. Now, let's start with the first area of disclosure. The assessment of whether an entity controls another entity sometimes requires significant judgment. In developing IFRS 10, the board avoided quantitative threshold and developed a single basis for consolidation that requires a holistic assessment, and for IFRS 11 joint arrangement, a model based on the rights and obligations. Here we provide two examples. The first example is where a company explains why it exercises control over an investee in which it has only 50% of ownership interest. And the second example in the next page is where a company cannot exercise significant influence even with a 25% of the interest. So here comes our question. So do you, in this area of disclosure of significant judgments and assumptions about the relationship between the investor and the investee, do you receive sufficient information to understand the nature of the interests. And if the nature, if the interest is a joint arrangement, whether it is a joint operation or joint venture, I will hand over to the members to open the discussion.
Thanks, Jen. So just to reiterate that, you know, the board in putting these standards together, as Jen said, avoided bright lines. So having more than 50% of ownership wouldn't determine that that was necessary a subsidiary. This is, as Jen decided, a more holistic assessment based around control and equally judgments around whether something's a joint operation or joint venture, or where you have an example, more than 25% or more than 20%, but you don't deem to have significant influence. So I think the question is about, are you getting enough information about why entities have made those judgments? Not just questions of fact that they have made those judgments, but explanations as to why they made those judgments. So could I open that up to members for views? Are we taking silence as consent here? Larissa has a comment. Over to you, Larissa. Thank you.
Thank you. I would say not consent, confusion. So it's a question almost more than a statement. And part of the reason why I'm unsure if this is the right place, and please tell me if it's not, but a lot of my companies, so when you get the regional players that have a lot of interest across a lot of companies and tend to range anything between your classic 19.9 to outright subsidiary ownership. On the reasoning, I haven't seen anything particularly useful, although I do appreciate the fact that you have to draw a line somewhere. Where I find this challenging is actually in comparing between companies in the non-IFRS disclosures. For example, on operating drivers, I'm very confused as to which companies are included at 100% and excluded later, which ones are already adjusted proportionately, which ones are consolidated, and which ones do something in between. So the question is, is there a way that we can encourage that kind of disclosure is provided for the non-IFRS metrics? And I fear the answer is no. As for the rest, the example that we have on the screen is the percentage interest in the main activity. I personally would appreciate a little bit more color around the why. I find the what quite evident. I must admit, I find the why lacking. And if there's a way to distinguish between the larger entities and the smaller ones, if there is a blanket assessment, I would personally find that helpful in understanding what goes into the numbers.
Thanks, Larissa. Let me address your first question around non-IFRS numbers. So the board's project on primary financial statements does address key performance metrics, which we have defined. We've talked about them as being subtotals of measures of income and expense. So these are P&L related measures, and a set of disclosures around those key management performance measures that we believe would provide greater transparency and discipline to how those measurements have been worked up from the IFRS numbers, with also requirements as to whether those measures, those computations have changed from year to year. And so we that is something that has generally been well received by stakeholders. I expect it to be re-deliberated by the board as it considers the stakeholder response to those proposals within the next month or so. So that's certainly on our agenda within another project, which I think will help the concern that you have expressed there. But in relation to this PII, I think what you're saying is that actually the examples, for instance, that we have on the screen are almost matters of fact rather than telling us the why, as to why they've reached that judgment. Is that right? I can see you nodding, but I don't want to put words into your mouth.
No, you summarize it very nicely. I find the what very easy. and very apparent. A little bit more commentary on the why personally I would find helpful. I would be interested to know if I'm on my lone soapbox or if anybody else experiences the same frustration.
Thanks, Larissa.
Thank you, Nick.
Mary, you would like to ask a question.
Just to follow up on Larissa's comment, if we, you know, if we look at this somewhat simplified example, you were saying it gives you the what, which is pretty obvious, but not the why. And I guess I think that's a helpful comment. I just want to probe a bit more to say, if I looked at this and said, okay, so it gives me the fact about they own 50%. I'm not sure that there's much judgment here. Do you want the why for everything, even if it's just confirming kind of the obvious? Or is it more if there's an apparent mismatch between the conclusion of consolidation, but percentage owns shows 40%, for example, is it only in the exception basis that the apparent mismatch that you're looking for more about the why?
Oh, no, thank you. Absolutely on the exception basis. And it's instances like this one where it's a gray area and you can go one of three ways probably. Where it would be interesting. For the rest, please don't kill any more trees or add any more volume that doesn't add value.
Thanks, Larissa. Any other views? Perhaps those who are Oliver, actually.
Just following up from Larissa's point, and again, I don't know if this is directly what we're asking about, but on a similar note of the, you know, JVs and associates, the material. What's material, what's non-material. So companies I tend to look at will just make it, there's just one line saying these are not material, typically. You rarely find ones that say they are material and there's no further description. And so I'd have to dig into the standards and maybe you define what it is and they should be saying that. Maybe I've missed it in the report and accounts. But again, just to the point that, you know, you can see the facts, but actually just a bit of more narrative explaining why. Because I've got examples where I would absolutely deem those JVs and associates material under my definition, and I will include them in, you know, thinking about the operating performance of the business and view them as operating assets. But the company, you know, has that one line that says these are not material, and therefore I think then it doesn't have to provide as much detail anyway, which I think we're going to get onto. But so again, a bit more description would be helpful.
You're absolutely right. We will get on to that, Oliver, but I think the particular point that you're making is one that we haven't included in that later section, that again, the why that something is deemed to be material or immaterial would be a helpful explanation. Jeremy.
Well, thank you. No, I agree with Oliver's comments on the materiality. And I suppose just thinking about Larissa's comments, what would be interesting where there's material items, the counterfactual, what would happen if they'd judged in the other way? And I can think of motivations to classify something as a subsidiary if they want to bolster their sales number, or maybe classify something as an equity investment if it's loss-making. So is it possible to ask for a description that would give sufficient information to recast the accounts if it were to give a different impression if they were to make another judgment?
Thanks, Jeremy. Any other further observations on the first question that we have? Oliver, thank you.
No, just again, follow on from Jeremy there. The other thing I'd add is debt as well. I mean, you talked about sales and but debt as well. You know, if you want to suddenly drop your ownership by, you know, suddenly your equity accounting, you've got a clear choice there versus a subsidiary accounting. And I think it will probably come out in the later questions in terms of what you actually have to provide in extra information. It's something I've seen in the past and or I'm aware of and I've spoken about around, you know, the debt that might be held in equity accounted, you know, associates and JVs, which, you know, you could argue the subsidiary side of things, or at least a material that should be provided. would add that.
Thanks, Oliver. We could, I think if there are no further comments, I think we could move on to the next question. But again, could I just remind everyone, if you're not speaking, please could you ensure that you're muted? We're getting some feedback again, just in the most recent comments. Jen, shall we move on to the next section?
Sure. Thank you, Nick. Thank you for the comments. The next area of disclosure is about subsidiaries that are consolidated by the parent. In developing the disclosure requirement, the board sought to respond to call from investors, first to improve information to identify profit loss and cash flow attributable to the shareholding of the parent and those attributable to the non-controlling interest. And secondly, improve information on the nature and extent of significant restrictions on ability of subsidiaries to transfer funds to the parent. And certainly, the information about terms of contractual arrangement that could require an entity to provide the financial support to a consolidated structured entity. Slide number 18 and 19 are examples of disclosure of subsidiaries with material non-controlling interests. This group identifies four subsidiaries to disclose profit and dividends attributable to non-controlling interests, as well as some summarized financial information of these subsidiaries, including both financial positioning items and financial performance items. And the next slide, slide 20, is an example of significant restrictions, that particular amount of cash is not available for use in the wider group. So here comes our question again, similar to the previous one. In this area, the disclosure about interest in subsidiaries, especially when required to disclose a subsidiary with non-controlling interests and those associated significant restrictions, do you receive sufficient information on this area? I'll hand back over to the members.
Great, thanks, Jen. So really two issues here bound up in this question. Are you getting sufficient information about interest in subsidiaries, those subsidiaries where there are minority interests or non-controlling interests? And secondly, where there are restrictions, and the example we have was restrictions on, for instance, moving cash around the group from a subsidiary, moving up the group structure, for instance, are you getting sufficient information on any restrictions that may be present that would prevent that? So with that, let me turn it over to members for any views. Terence, thank you.
Thanks, Nick. So I just wanted to pick up on a point on slide 17 around the consequences of losing control. So I feel from what I've seen, this isn't necessarily an area that I get that much insight into. And I think it's important for a couple of reasons. Firstly, there's clearly judgment involved in the conclusion that a company makes in terms of whether it consolidates an entity or not. And I guess there's two important things to note is due to that. One is, it's obviously a judgment, and judgments can change or circumstances can change in terms of the economic ownership. And the consequences of that, I don't feel either the kind of the first or second order consequences are necessarily being properly addressed by companies. As an example, I was looking at an FMCG company, which in their case, they have just over 50% ownership in an entity, and they choose to consolidate. It's not clear that if they didn't consolidate, what that would mean. But if you follow the company closely enough, you would know that it would significantly impact their credit rating if they didn't consolidate the results of that entity, to the point where it would impact their ability to raise debt under the current terms that they do. But that's not mentioned anywhere in the disclosure. And I've seen similar instances in other companies where the choice to consolidate is beneficial for the company at a group level. So that's my point.
Thanks, Terence. Matthias?
Yeah, but very quickly only regarding the information on the subsidiaries with material non-controlling interest. That's a very positive point for me because it really touches this, as I think, often neglected question of how to value the non-controlling interest. So very often we have very complicated models, and then at the end we put a multiple on the non-controlling interest, if at all. Perhaps we only take the book value, and this now helps, a lot to, if necessary, do at least more proper valuation of non-controlling interest than we could before. Also, the restrictions, of course, on cash, as it is shown here in the example, is something which is helpful.
So Matthias, just to clarify, I think what we're showing you is an example that we found in practice rather than a proposal from the board. But in practice, are you getting the information you need about non-controlling interest? I'm not sure from what you said that you are finding that information.
Yeah, no, but I had a couple of experiences where I found better information, or found some information on this. But I'm focusing here on this example. Yeah, that's true. If it is, if companies provide this information as they do it here, this would be helpful. Yeah.
Okay, thank you for clarifying that, Bertrand.
Yes, just some comments. I agree that this is important in order to make a proper valuation. I would add some things. Is that the information is nice, but what would be more helpful is that to get information that is consistent in presentation with the primary financial statements. And there are some points that I would like to add is that when you present current assets and current liabilities, for example, or long-term assets and long-term liabilities, the issue is that you doesn't disaggregate between, I would say, operating assets and financial assets, and it's same for liabilities. And I think it's important. There is also the issue of cash flow, because you present the operating cash flow, but what would be interesting and that to have the free cash flow, the capex side, and so on, so that to be able to understand what are the economics of the subsidiaries, and also to make proper valuation of non-controlling interest. And this, I would add simply that this could be also reflected in what I expect of later on about the improvement of the statement of cash flow on the primary financial statement when you could have more information about non-controlling interest. But maybe we can discuss this later on the agenda consultation. Those are my comments. Thank you. And of course, on the restricted cash, which is important. Thank you.
Thanks, Bertrand. Mary, you had an observation you wanted to share with us, I think.
I did. Just listening to a couple of comments, it makes me realize that I think it would be very helpful if people could comment on whether they see compliance issues, as in the objectives would give us, you know, the objectives and requirements that you sketch out, you know, that's then presented as the current requirements in the standard, would provide useful information, and we are getting it or we're not getting it, or whether your comment is what the requirements focus on, needs rethinking. Because if you're saying we'd like this information, is it because people, in your sense, aren't meeting the requirements, or is it because there's something that may be missing in what is required to be provided? Thanks, Nick.
Thanks, Mary. Very nicely put. Coy, tell us about your experience.
Thank you. I think slide 18 is very useful information. I think that the standards should require this disclosure of the breakdown of non-consolidating interest and net income or loss attributable to non-controlling interest by company, as described in today's agenda paper. The current standard requires disclosure of material subsidiaries, but it would be more useful to disclose that breakdown to ensure comprehensiveness. Thank you.
Thank you. Florian.
Yeah, I agree with Matthias, and I can't stress enough how important a topic this is, particularly the non-controllable interest, because our experience has been this has been the area where management is most likely to try to pull wool over your eyes by sort of skipping over that area. So thereby it's become very important to put this into our model. And actually we over the last 6 months, we actually have updated our model to explicitly take these into consideration. It's our standard financial valuation model. In terms of the question that I think Mary asked, I don't think we have an issue with compliance. Most of the companies give us sufficient information, which is even broader than what we see here on page 18, which enables us to do a better valuation of the subsidiaries. What we are lacking a little bit is, again, disclosure around long-term commitments, right? So they give us the current year, but they don't give us sort of the disclosure of, you know, having that company and that company, that subsidiary and that subsidiary accruing significant value towards the holding structure, but obviously part of that is distributed to a third party. And but what is our commitment to that subsidiary and thereby to continue distribution of value to that third party? Right. So we kind of get the financial statement snapshot, but not sort of this is what we need to do. This is what we are contractually obliged to do over the next several years. But it's not reflected in our sort of balance sheet liabilities. Does that make sense what I'm saying?
No, absolutely. No, I understand. So, look, you know, obviously equity markets are forward looking. And to give you a sense of, you know, those perspectives or the likely, as you say, commitments to that business over the longer term.
So, Neil, exactly. Just an example. Yeah. Just as an example, right? So we had a company which had a subsidiary which was like 25% of their earnings, and it was growing significantly faster. But that subsidiary had an exclusion towards a certain regional market, right? But that was nowhere clear. So it was clear that that subsidiary would become larger over time because that market they were serving exclusively was growing faster than the rest of the market, right? And this was sort of created sort of the valuation differentials.
Great, that's a helpful example. For us to have. Thank you. Sunil, please, can I pass over to you?
A few things. One is, sometimes the non-controlling material subsidiaries are held through a step-down interlay company. And any change in ownership indirectly of the non-controlling interest in the subsidiary is not reported in the financial numbers. So I think one is the quantitative aspect. Any change in direct or indirect ownership in that subsidiary somehow does not get reported. And we have seen instances where, a valuable investment sometimes is hived off without the shareholders even directly not being aware of it. So that is one point. The second thing is the quarterly results which the companies declare. One is not able to get any info on whether the profit is operational or non-operational. Because, you know, even in this example given, we have just said profit attributable to non-controlling interest. whether this profit is from business activity or it is through some other income or other expense, it is very difficult to come to know by this one line, you know. So that also makes it very difficult to understand whether the reported profit is actually sustainable or non-sustainable.
Thanks, Sunil. And again, some of those issues about making it clear what is part of operating profit and what isn't go back to the work the board's doing in its primary financial statements project. There, the proposal is for associates and joint ventures to be always excluded from operating profit, which is a term that hitherto hasn't been defined within our standards. So hopefully that would help. Jeremy, let me pass over to you.
Oh, thank you. I just want to, I suppose, reiterate Matthias's point that the valuation is the key question for the user to try and value these non-controlling interests. And sometimes there isn't always the information to do that in practice. So if I distinguish between a publicly listed company that's a subsidiary with a non-controlling interest, that's clearly easy to value. That's not the problem. It's when it's private, there's more of a problem. Therefore, there's more need for disclosure. And I suppose there's three general problems. There's too much aggregation, so mixing companies together to understand that line item. The problem is more pronounced when they're loss-making subsidiaries because it's more difficult to work out what they're worth. And if they're growing as well, that all can also can distort things. So again, it goes back to the question in the valuation, is the book value of non-controlling interests in any way a fair reflection of the market value of non-controlling interests? And that's the hard thing to do. And certainly any more information on the cash flows as to are they coming, what's the claim on cash flows from non-controlling interests would be very helpful.
Thanks, Jeremy. And I see in the chat, Larissa strongly agreeing with the sentiments that you have just expressed there. Bertram, you had some further remarks you'd like to add.
Yes, it's just an add-on with my comments that I made about the consistency of plantation with PFS and so also the disaggregation is not only valid for the subsidiaries with material non-controlling interests, but it's also, I would say, applicable for the GVs and associates, just general comments.
Thanks, Bertram. That's all very helpful feedback. Jen, shall we move on to the next section?
Sure. Let's move on to slide 22. This is area of joint ventures and associates which are accounted for applying the equity method. In developing the disclosure requirement of IFRS 12, the board noted joint arrangement and associates could share a common disclosure objective to disclose information that enable the users of financial statements to evaluate the nature, extent, and financial effect of an entity's interest in joint arrangements and associates, and the nature of the risk associated with those interests. IFRS 12 requires a company to disclose summarized financial information of joint venture and associates that are material, and for those individually immaterial joint venture and associates, only aggregated financial information is required. So as you can see, slide 23 and 24 illustrate an example of material joint venture and associates disclosures. The financial information includes revenue, profit, loss, other comprehensive income, as well as financial positioning items such as current and non-current assets and liabilities. The disclosure at the bottom of the slide 24 reconcile from the net assets of the joint venture and associates to their carrying value of the investments in the company's balance sheet. And slide 25 demonstrate for immaterial joint venture and associates. Compared to this disclosure of a material ones, there is less information to be required for individually immaterial joint venture and associates. So basically aggregated financial performance related metrics are disclosed for these individually immaterial ones. Next slide for the question. So again, in this area, the area of joint ventures and associates that account for using the equity method, do you receive sufficient information for you to maybe evaluate the these interests. I would hand over back to members for discussion.
So we've already touched upon joint ventures and associates and some of our previous comments from members. And I think as we address this issue, it's worth thinking about Mary's question as well. Is this an issue about the existing requirements, or is this an issue with compliance with those requirements? So with that, can I pass over to Mateus?
Yeah, thanks, Nick. It's correct. We already touched this point, in particular in the context of, and this is something I would like to emphasize, in the context of the primary financial statement project. I think it's necessary to look at the disclosure requirements. So in the exposure draft, general presentation and disclosure, there was a new line in the profit and loss statement called share of profit or loss of integral associates and joint ventures, which is a bit, I think on other occasions we have discussed a lot about this, a bit odd because it doesn't really fit into an operating profit level because it's an equity, so after tax, after interest number. And so if I want to make use of this information, I need more information so that I can bring it also to operating profit level, perhaps, or that I can apply it in multiples consistently. And that's why I really need this information from the associates and the joint ventures, that at least I'm able to translate, if this number stays in the profit and loss statement as it is on a net basis, that I'm able to translate it so that I can consistently apply multiples. And this requires a lot of information. Here in this example, there's it's possible to translate it, I think, but that's something which I haven't seen so often. So to summarize, please see this disclosure requirements in the context of what you plan with the primary financial statement project.
So thanks, Mateus. If I can just give you a brief update on the proposals in the primary financial statements projects and the status of those. The board will be re-deliberating its proposals over the next few months, including the proposals around integral joint ventures and associates. I think it's on the record already that the feedback that we have received there has been lukewarm. So it'll be interesting to see if the board follows through on those proposals. I don't think it moves away from your substantive point that you need more information than just something being presented on a net basis for associates and joint ventures. But yes, there'll be further news from the board on whether it proceeds with integral and non-integral associates and joint ventures. Thank you. Oliver. Hi, Oliver, can I ask you to comment?
Yeah, sorry, I was on mute. I'll just firstly echo what Jeremy talked about on valuation regarding question two, and it's as relevant, I think, for JVs and associates here as well, in terms of you know, how you might make adjustments to your enterprise value if you are not including these JVs and associates in your profit number. So the more information, the better. I think the information that's shown there on slide 23 and 24, and if that is the information that's been expected of companies to show when they have material JVs and associates, I think is very helpful. Mm-hmm. Again, echoing what I said earlier, I don't understand why a company's saying they're not, the JVs and associates are not material, and therefore they're not providing this. And I think why this information is so important is because in the case where, you know, a JV and associate is viewed as an operating asset, essentially, you know, one wants to have the flexibility to look at operating profitability, including the share of profits from JVs and associates. And to what Mateus just said, you know, obviously at the moment we're giving them all on a post-tax basis. And so it's very difficult. And I think that, you know, where the information's available, I think that could really improve analysis or the flexibility that people have to decide whether they want to view that as operating or not. And, you know, I appreciate that, you know, JVs, you know, are structured maybe as separate legal entities, and so therefore you don't have a claim on that sort of gross profit. It's more the net profit side of things potentially, but this is about trying to understand earnings power and value. So I think that's really important. And I noticed there that in slide 24 at the bottom there, there is at least a number that tells you about the tax expense, that, you know, but more information around tax to enable us to get a pre-tax number would be really helpful. And maybe just give you a live example of why. So maybe this is helpful or not, but take 30 seconds. If there's a company that maybe is a contracting company, and it has contracts all over the world in whatever a service or product or service it provides, and often, you know, the law of that individual country they might be operating in might say, well, you have to do it through a JV, for example. So they have no other option. If they want to operate their business in country X, they have to do it through a JV where they have a minority ownership. So I personally, in that case, see that as part of their operating assets, and that's why I think it's so important. I can be more specific on the example if you want, but that's my point there.
Perhaps staff could follow up with you if they feel they want more information on that. That's great, Oliver. Philip.
Thanks, Nick. I suppose to answer the question, do you get enough information on JVs and associates? Not always is probably the answer. The compliance question, I don't know whether it's non-compliance or whether it's a problem with the requirements. I'm not familiar enough with them to be able to answer that. But just on the slide before, from a credit analysis point of view, where we have the disclosure of the cash and cash equivalents and the financial liabilities, that's very helpful. Having a bucket of non-current liabilities and current liabilities isn't particularly helpful, because we're quite interested, obviously, in the debt that those associates and joint ventures have. I think the other area where I struggle is, and it comes back to the disclosure that we had before of why something's a subsidiary, is perhaps why something's not a subsidiary. So, you know, if you're owning 51% of something and you're equity accounting it, you know, you're equity accounting for it, why are you doing that? Why do you not have control? And, you know, I think those explanations tend to be a bit wishy-washy, and maybe that's because the reality is it is a bit wishy-washy, and it's difficult to articulate. But you know, I think that's a helpful disclosure to have if it's made properly as well.
Great, thanks, Philip. Deirdre.
I suppose I would agree with all of the comments that have been made to date. We adjust our valuation for JVs, associates, significant subsidiaries, etc. So just to reiterate, all of the disclosure we can get is incremental. Our incremental disclosure we can get is obviously very helpful in that process. In preparation, I did reach out to the energy sector, because I did remember back to, I think we had a discussion around IFRS 6, I can't even remember when it was, but just to point out, and I think it boils back to this materiality question, you know, the disclosure you have there for the materials, associates and JV looks quite comprehensive on the face of it, but my energy colleagues would point out, you know, an awful lot of their entities would have a series of JVs and associates that on an individual basis are not material, but as a sum for the entity, they're quite material. And therefore, in that instance, they're not getting enough disclosure, and it's very difficult for them to try and consolidate or make an enterprise value adjustment for the purposes of those JVs. So just a kind of a question around that materiality question. You know, should there be a requirement to think of it as an aggregate as opposed to always on an individual? That's it.
Thank you, Deirdre. Good observation. Larissa, please.
Thank you. Three quick points. The most important one is that we've been discussing on an entity basis, but I would like to raise all the concerns effectively, but extended to segmental analysis. And a lot of what was said, so first thing on Oliver's point,
let me just stop you there, if I may be so rude, Larissa, because we're just about to come on to the interaction between segment analysis and joint ventures and associates in a moment. So it may it just maybe more pertinent to pick up those comments then, if you don't mind.
Not at all.
No, thank you very much. Koi.
Thank you. I think that if affiliates are listed, there lies gain or loss by a company at the end of the period should be disclosed. It's my short comments. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Koi. Mary, did you have some observations before we just move on to the next section?
If I could... Let me throw out for a sanity check a sense that I'm getting. It started out as just confirming something that Matthias said, but Oliver's comments, I think, that led me down this path. I am getting the sense that if you got the information on slides 23 and 24 for each material associate, that... The 23 and 24 illustrate what you'd consider in many cases to be good disclosure about individually material associates and joint ventures. And sometimes it's very helpful. I mean, I've heard some very useful comments already about what you are trying to do with the information. And one of the things we've learned is it's very helpful if we can tell preparers in the context of the standard what the purpose of the disclosure is. But it, you know, it's also very useful if we can say this is approximately the kind of level of information that people are looking for. You know, I heard... Deirdre's reminder about individually immaterial that aggregate to material. And Philip, I think you were questioning something about the aggregation, the balance sheet aggregation on slide, must be slide 23. But, you know, overall, if what we're hearing from this session and this discussion is this is approximately what you're looking for material associates and joint ventures, that's a very helpful reference point to have. Nick, you know, I don't know if you agree or not, or if you think it's overreaching to say that, but that was my sense of people's comments.
No, I think that's fair. And Matthias, you also wanted to, sorry, just respond.
Yeah, very quickly. Yeah, that's basically true. I mean, I can derive all the information, or most of the information here from this set of disclosure. Yeah.
Great. Thanks, Matthias. And Philip remarks in the chat that he's happy to agree with that also. So Jen, I'm just cognizant of time. I know you've got a couple of other questions that you'd like to pose. So let's move on. And this ties into what Larissa was talking about a moment ago in terms of associates and joint ventures and segment analysis.
Yeah. Thank you, Nick. Slide 27 to 29 set out scenarios we'd like to discuss further in this area of joint venture associates. So we are keen to understand more from your perspective the related disclosures. The first scenario is some companies disclose their segment information by including their share of revenue, share of profit loss, assets and liabilities of a joint venture associates. And of course, according to the standard, these joint ventures and associates are accounted for applying the equity method and reporting in a single line item on the balance sheet. And the company in slide 28 has added the share of revenue of its joint venture and associates to the consolidated revenue to present so-called combined revenue, which is, of course, is greater than the consolidated revenue on the statement of financial performance. So as just discussed, IFRS 12 requires disclosure of summarized financial information, as you can see on the slide 23, of material joint venture and associates. So we should be able to calculate the share of revenue based on that disclosure. However, that disclosure is not required to be presented at segment level. But slide 28 is only one example. We also notice example that include share of particular assets and liabilities of joint venture associates in their segment note. So basically, we are asking questions about what do you think about this information? Will you use it, and how do you use it? Thank you.
Thanks, Jen. So let me first go to Larissa, who I very rudely interrupted a moment ago, to just say, is this would this be helpful, or is there something else around segments that would be more helpful when we come to associates and joint ventures?
My apologies. I read the slides on Sunday and forgot there was a segment on segments, and I clearly have strong views in this regard. I really like the presentation on slide 28. The big reason for my feeling so strongly about this is that I certainly find in my companies, I often find you come across JVs and associates that may not be materially relevant, but if you take them down to a segment level, they are strategically relevant. And that becomes very interesting. I have seen, this is rather concise disclosure. I've seen other examples also where you don't need reams of pages to get concise information across, because this is exactly the kind of the combined revenue, the combined operating drivers, the combined profits at a pre-tax level that make the information helpful.
Thanks, Larissa. Any other observations or views here? Bertrand?
Sorry, yes. Yes, just one comment and why it could be helpful. I don't know if it is helpful, but there is an issue, I think, with regard to the how the IFRS 11 is applied. My understanding is that IFRS 11 is based on legal things. It means the obligation between the partners to segregate between GVA and joint operation. And in some cases, you need to have, let's say, GVA in some countries, where based on the analysis of IFRS 11, it's a GVA. But it could be considered also sometimes as a, from an economic point of view, as a joint operation. So there may be some interest or some to have a better understanding of the on the economics of the company to have this addition. I don't think this is always the case, but in some cases you could have some better understanding of the economics of a company to add or to consolidate, I would say, not to add, but to consolidate. I would not say on a proportionate basis, but based on joint operation analysis, this kind of numbers. So this is a comment, and so this relates to the way you consolidate GV and joint arrangements.
Thank you, Bertrand. Jeremy, you would like to comment?
You know, I think this is very helpful, and it goes to the point that it's really useful for valuation, just to know the simple point, what's the scale of the joint venture revenues relative to the consolidated part of the company? And to answer the question, how do I use it? Sometimes I think we're forced to use it because the company guidance for revenue in the future is based on their definition of combined revenue rather than the IFRS definition of revenue. So sometimes we're forced to use that. So it's having a reconciliation between their guidance of revenue and the accounts is very helpful.
Thanks, Jeremy. Jen, do you want to move on again to the next section?
Yeah, thank you, Nick. I guess we can skip the next findings, which we have already touched upon, the material one. Then we can go to the last area of structure entity. So the last area is about structure entity, which responds to the need for improved disclosure about an entity's exposure to risk from off-balance sheet activities when the board developed IFRS 12. The aim of the disclosure requirement is for the user to understand the nature of interest in unconsolidated structure entity, as well as the risks associated with these entities. And as you can see in slide 31 is an example in which a company participates in a securitization vehicle Y and determine that the company does not control the vehicle Y according to the control definition. And the company transfers trade receivable upon sales of goods, but does not de-recognize its trade receivable according to the requirement in IFRS 9. So applying IFRS 12, the company is required to explain its relationship with Y as well as its risk that is associated with the interest, which in this case is the trade receivable transferred to vehicle Y that are included on the balance sheet of the group. So the question for this area is still about whether you receive sufficient information regarding structured entities, whether they are consolidated under the subsidiary or unconsolidated, so-called off-balance sheet activities. I will hand over back to the members.
Thanks. Thanks, Jen. Deirdre, let me pass over to you, please.
I suppose just a brief comment from my side. Obviously, the disclosure, or the standard improved the disclosure dramatically. I can remember a time when we spent all our post-2009, all of our lives looking at the consolidated and unconsolidated structured entities to try and understand what the absolute risks were for the financial stakes. I'd say the disclosure is obviously massively improved post the standard. I suppose I don't spend as much time looking at the disclosure today as I did, you know, even 7 years ago. And I think that reflects the fact that regulation and disclosure has kind of caught up with these vehicles to a certain extent. So a lot of entities will be quite cautious about how much risk they're taking in these vehicles. Now, that obviously doesn't preclude them from taking substantial risk, and it's quite a difficult area for, I think, an accounting standard to, enlighten us in terms of the ultimate risk. But your last question with regards to what's the missing information and what could be of use, and I was trying to tease that one out and came to the conclusion it might be useful if these vehicles were required to give us an understanding of the duration of the liabilities or the assets that are included in these entities. Sometimes they do, but often they don't. And the only reason I'm alighting on that is obviously, for example, we've obviously got Greensill going on at the moment, and there'll be different entities who have potential risks allocated to them off balance sheet due to Greensill and how that evolves. And for me, as a user, as these entities disclose what their exposure is, I'll be very interested to know what the duration of that risk is, and therefore I can, you know, try and quantify in my own head how I want to factor that risk in. So overall, good standard, definitely improved disclosure. It's a very difficult area to conclude on in terms of, is the disclosure sufficient? But I do think maybe identifying the duration of the assets and liabilities might be a nice incremental step to provide us with some more insight.
That's helpful to hear. Thanks, Deirdre. Matthias, please.
Yeah, fully agree with Deirdre. From my personal perspective, I really have to admit that I have a history of messing up investments because of such information is missing. I also had some successful ones, so no worries. but that's really helpful. So that's an improvement. Without going into details, what is necessary in each particular case, but in general, I mean the SIC 12 disappeared, and now it comes back in a better way here via disclosure, and I also think disclosure is the best way to deal with this. So positive.
Thanks, Matthias. Philip, please, over to you.
Thanks, Nick. I mean, maybe just from, you know, a credit analysis side, you know, I think what we're always interested in for any of these entities is the financing structure and you know, how that's been put in place, particularly any debt-like liabilities there, and also, you know, the cash flows of that entity and how it's going to repay that debt, whether or not it's guaranteed within the group or whether or not the group takes responsibility for it or not. One thing to mention here, just on unconsolidated, it's probably the wrong place to mention it, but I've brought up the investment holding company exemption before. And, you know, again, from a credit perspective, we find that quite difficult because, again, the information about the financing of those entities and the cash flows that they're generating can be missing. Again, I don't know if that's a compliance problem or if the disclosure just doesn't need to be given, but certainly there are instances where we don't have it, and we could certainly use it.
Thanks, Philip. Any more comments around structured entities? That doesn't seem to be the case. Terence, you have a comment more of a general nature.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, I should have brought this up maybe earlier, but just following on from the cash flow discussion, I feel like we lack sufficient disclosure around the cash flows of JVs and associates. And for those of us who don't necessarily use earnings-based multiples, for example, we focus very much on free cash flow. It's not ideal, I guess, kind of current disclosure that we have from that perspective. And then just kind of beyond just the evaluation point, kind of more generally, you don't necessarily get a great sense of the earnings quality of some of those earnings, both from the lack of detail around maybe one-off gains, et cetera, but then just linking it back to the cash flow point, it's difficult to assess the earnings quality. You can't look at things like working cap. You can't look at cash conversion. So it can be difficult to get a proper sense of the quality of some of those earnings. That was just what I wanted to raise.
Thanks, Terence. And I can see Jeremy agreeing with those sentiments in the chat. So Jen, I'm again conscious that we're slightly over time, and I think hopefully there's a lot of good information there for members. Anything further that you would like to conclude on?
Not really. We are going on with our outreach before the end of comment period, and we will see after the receiving of these comment letters and present to the board a summary of the comment letter. Then we will decide what's the next step.
Great, thanks, Jen. And just seeing in the chat again, lots more other members agreeing with Terence's views on the lack of cash flow disclosures for joint ventures, just to record that formally. So that concludes our session, IFRS 10, 11, 12. We're going to take a break now. Let's take a break to 20 past. If you're quick, you'll be able to grab a coffee or a sandwich. And then we'll come back and pick up with rate regulated activities at 20 past the hour. Thank you.